Welcome to Talking Paper on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Christian Needon. The first part of this episode, I interview Nathaniel Holt and Sean Kornhauser. They are the filmmaking team whose work explores the fantasy genre card game Magic the Gathering, which launched in 1993 and has over 10 million players worldwide. In 2011, they began making documentary videos about the game's Pro Tour. The popularity of those videos on YouTube attracted the attention of Magic manufacturer Wizards of the Coast, who hired the duo to continue their series, Walking the Plains, and produce other video content for the company's website and YouTube channel. In 2016, they released the documentary film Enter the Battlefield, Life on the Magic the Gathering Pro Tour, which follows seven Magic players over the course of one tour season, including Chris Pakula, who I interview in the second part of this episode of Talking Paper. The film's narration is provided by actor Will Wheaton, who provides the following intro to the film.
You have probably heard the words Magic the Gathering at least once in the last two decades. Perhaps you have a friend who disappears once a week to cast spells. Maybe it's your spouse or your child. Or maybe you've got a shoebox full of magic safely stowed in your parents' attic, a relic from summer vacations long ago. Or maybe you don't know anything at all about the cardboard phenomenon with 20 million players from all over the planet, some of whom are consumed with the quest to become the world's best in their town, in their country, and in the world. For those unfamiliar, Magic the Gathering is a fantasy-themed collectible card game, the oldest and most popular of its genre. The game is made by Wizards of the Coast, and there have been over 14,000 distinct card designs printed to date. Players collect the cards, sold in various packs and bundles, create decks from them, and battle against each other using the strategies they've crafted within those decks. For instance, one player might harness the power of vampires, while another prefers to command large wild beasts. Still another might choose the trickery of mind magic, while her opponent would rather just incinerate everything in a giant ball of flames. To achieve victory on the battlefield, players wield up to five colors of magical energy while managing resources such as lands, creatures, spells, artifacts, a life total, and in some cases, the dead things in the graveyard. For Magic players, the game's fantasy flavor combined with its challenging analytical strategy make for a sublime gaming experience, one that's enchanted millions of players in dozens of countries around the world.
For my Talking Paper interview with the filmmakers, I began by asking Nathaniel about his own introduction to Magic the Gathering.
A lot of people remember it from the mid-90s because there was kind of a boom, a fad going around various middle school cafeterias, and I was very much a part of that. I collected obsessively. I played on living room carpets and kitchen tables with my childhood friends, and then I put away the cards like everybody else did as soon as I got tired of them, and for many, many, many years, they stayed locked in my attic until in about 2010, I discovered them again, played some games with my roommates. We had a little trip down memory lane, a nostalgic hobby from, 15 years ago. I was shocked to find out that Magic was still being published and produced and that there was a thriving community, in fact, a growing community of Magic players. So I fell back into the game pretty hard. I became obsessive about it again. I consumed content on the internet about it. I found out that there are professional tournaments. I followed the pro players. I built decks. I collected. I became very competitive with my friends and went to local game stores and basically became very consumed with the hobby. I had a lot of free time in my hands living as the significant other of a graduate student at Penn State University. There is really nothing to do there if you're not affiliated with the university, so I had a lot of time to myself to get obsessed with Magic. But then I moved back to Philadelphia, where I had spent a lot of my young career as an actor, and in this DIY art scene that we're very proud of here in Philadelphia. And I knew Sean Kornhauser through that. And we had made some videos together. Sean had spent some time in film school. Sean and I made a few videos together just for art galleries and warehouse studio collectives and just kind of part of this bohemian hipstery type scene that we were in. And when I moved back to Philadelphia later in 2011 and Sean had had spent some time away and had moved back to Philadelphia. We wanted to work together again, and I just had the idea of showing up to a professional Magic tournament, which happened to be in Philadelphia. We went. It was very much on a lark. We didn't really know what we were doing. We were kind of improvising, but it was pretty funny. I was operating on very little sleep. I was an after-hours bartender at the time. It would work until 5 or 6 in the morning. It was not a professional, slick operation, but it was, I guess, just funny enough to go viral within the Magic community. And so the YouTube comments really, really wanted us to keep going with it. And I had never heard of Kickstarter before. I think it was very nascent at that time in 2011. Kickstarter was like just becoming a thing. And Sean really pushed hard for us to do a Kickstarter to go to the World Championships of Magic the Gathering in San Francisco. We did it. We got enough money to buy plane tickets over there. We were both very broke at the time, but we managed it. And after that, I think Magic players really, really wanted us to keep doing it. And Wizards of the Coast, the company that makes Magic, recognized that. And so Wizards of the Coast reached out. Our producer, Greg Collins, reached out to hire us and just kind of keep making more of the same. And that is really what Walking the Plains became.
Sean, starting from those early days, what were some of the filmmaking challenges of this particular style that you were pursuing with Walking the Plains?
Yeah, there were quite a few technical challenges. I mean, this was really something even though I'd had, I guess at that point when we first started, I'd probably had about 5-6 years of experience making videos of many different sorts and types. And this was one I'd never really attempted. Just going to a tournament and filming these people at a table, putting cards down, I did not know what the cards were at the time. I knew of Magic, wasn't a player. So I had to just figure out kind of on the fly different ways to film these people that seemed fun and exciting when they were just kind of sitting at a table, staring very intensely at each other, expressing no emotion, which is, advantageous to the player, but not to the camera operator. So that was one of the biggest challenges. And for a while, Nate and I decided it was good that I did not know about the game. We thought it made sense that I would sort of be approaching it from this very naive place and he would be the insider. So on a technical level, that, I don't know, kind of just meant whatever we showed or whatever content we came up with, I would be the one that would make sure that it was understandable to a new player or someone who didn't even know about the game. And that kept up for a while. After a couple episodes, or even up until we were hired, I did not know how to play the game. And then I learned how to play the game. And it still kind of stayed. We kept that dynamic up for a while. But over the years, it changed. And I think at a certain point, we felt like it was okay to not be so understandable to outsiders. And we kind of let a little bit more of the technical jargon into the episodes.
So many films, whether they're documentary or feature film, they don't really become what they're going to become until well into the editing process. What are the editing challenges of Walking the Plains and then moving into Enter the Battlefield?
Sure. The early days of Walking the Plains was very chaotic, I would say. We really were just grasping at straws at the beginning there. The first two episodes, we filmed the tournament, spent a week out in San Francisco for the World Championship, and we would come back to Philadelphia, and Nate would come over to this sort of loft space, and we would just sit on the couch watching all this footage, just every second of it together, taking notes, just really trying to figure out how to tell a story. And it was really hard. We really overshot every tournament at that point. We had no idea, how to kind of economize our time at that point, and just came home with just, hundreds of hours, dozens of hours of footage, way more than we needed. And it was really, really hard at the beginning to figure out how to tell those stories. Over time, and really, I think that first year was really helpful in just kind of figuring out the rhythm of a tournament and what kind of beats we wanted to hit on each episode. And I would say after a year, maybe two, we had a real, I would say, formula for each Walking the Plains episode. For the film, it was kind of a similar experience, to be honest. I had, at that point, a decade of experience making films and videos, and even some long-form projects, but nothing on that scale. So again, we shot and shot and shot and didn't have probably a super tight plan or outline for a while there. And then as we got midway into production and the pieces started falling into place, we got a good outline going. But it was a similar sort of exploratory stage where we were really just trying to figure it out as we went. It felt much better later on in the process, but I would say at the beginning it was similar to the beginning stages of Walking the Plains, where we were really just kind of discovering, you know, our own process for that project.
So for anyone that's seen Walking the Plains, one of the most well-known aspects of the series is the Planeswalker. Tell me about that character and how that reflects Walking the Plains concept.
A Planeswalker in Magic the Gathering folklore is a magical being, usually a humanoid, whether it's a human or an elf or a lion that stands on 2 feet. They kind of transport themselves between worlds, hence planes. They're walking the planes, and that's where the name of the series came from. My character of the wizard or the necromancer was kind of a throwback to the game's 90s mythology, where the player was considered a wizard as opposed to a planeswalker, which kind of conjures all the classical, like, Tolkien sort of hooded character, a druid-y kind of person with a staff casting magic spells. And so at first it started just as a joke. I thought it would just be funny to actually dress up as a wizard and go to these tournaments. Little did I know that in the coming years it would become quite fashionable for people to dress up as fictional characters and come to tournaments and do what's called cosplaying, and it became quite popular within Magic. But when Sean and I were doing it, there were no people doing this. Everybody stared at me like I was a freak wearing a wizard robe, and Sean's pointing a camera at me, and it just became kind of a hallmark of the series that it was my alter ego. The series is a blend of sketch comedy and documentary. So for sketch comedy, we wanted to show this kind of bumbling wizard who was full of bravado and self-confidence, and also just very grumpy and had lots of enemies but not very many friends, and was always losing battles and always down on his luck. That was the comedic thrust of that character. The way we ended the series on episode number 41, which came out a few months ago, was that the wizard throws down a rap song, and you know, just to diss all his haters from over the years, most of them imagined, to show off his amazing zombies as he's a necromancer, and get some dancing zombies on camera that Sean did a really great job capturing in the beautiful Woodland Cemetery, which is just a few blocks from where we're recording this interview right now in West Philadelphia.
Over the course of those 41 episodes, many people from Wizards of the Coast, many pro players have appeared. Tell me about that and how some of the times you guys have incorporated them into episodes.
Right. I think early on we realized that part of our meal ticket would be to put famous Magic players on camera, and then they could tweet out the link to our video because they wanted everybody to see them say something funny or have a cool interview. And this extended to employees at Wizards of the Coast, including Mark Rosewater, who was a recurring character. Mark is the head designer of Magic the Gathering, and he and I kind of had what we called a spy versus spy relationship. The wizard and Mark were always battling. Mark is usually winning, but he's kind of a funny guy. He had a background in comedy, was a writer for Roseanne, the sitcom, way back in the day before he was a game designer. So we had a lot of fun with that, and yeah, like I said, I think we realized part of our meal ticket would be, well, let's just get some attention-hungry famous Magic players on our video, and maybe the link will get passed around a little bit more than it would otherwise.
Very often on Walking the Plains, when you guys attended tournaments, you would either incorporate or document the filmmaking approach that was going on for telling the story of these tournaments, of these one-on-one competitions between players on screen. Let's talk about that style for a second. It seems like it's derived from pro poker. For the streamed footage at these tournaments, for the individual matches. What are your thoughts on that approach to telling the story of a match?
Well, there are a lot of challenges for the people in charge of the stream of a Magic tournament and a Magic match. Even though the cards have some really flavorful imagery and flavor text and there's a whole storyline going on in the game, you really don't get that when watching a match. You're seeing two players put these cards down on a table, and it's somewhat difficult to even see what the cards are unless they pop them up very large on the screen, which they do. But there's just a lot happening at once, as opposed to some other games where there's very vibrant visuals going on that's changing from moment to moment, that's very exciting with explosions. That's just not happening. So for the job of the producer and the commentators, they really, like you said, have to tell the story of the tournament and the match with not a ton of help. There's really just a table and two players that are not interacting outside of what they're putting on the table. So I think, in my mind, I don't see many other options aside from what they're doing. There's obviously ways to improve the quality of coverage or the stream. There's lots of different things which they've tried over the years, and I think since we started until now, it's greatly improved, and I think they are really open to trying new things. But the general approach, and as far as showing the top of the table, you know, the occasional image of their hand, I really don't see many other options to telling this story of the match.
A hallmark of Magic cards is this incredible artistry of each of the cards. It's really an amazing artistic achievement from set to set. Do you integrate the artwork into episodes that you do beyond just shots of the cards? Will you, say, get just close-ups of this artwork and maybe use that as part of a visual storytelling element?
Yeah, Nate and I love to try to incorporate the artwork as much as possible. The main times we've found that is possible is just either when we're interviewing a player and they're referencing a card, or we're talking about a card. We do pop up some high-resolution imagery on the screen of the artwork. Later on, in almost all of our episodes, we have a section where we detail the top eight or the sort of final rounds of the tournament. And Nate provides a really detailed, flavorful voiceover narration of everything that happens in this really fun way. And we, like you said, really like to showcase the artwork in those moments. And yeah, we'll pick and choose a few different images and show them on the screen. Because you're right, that is one of the best parts of Magic. And it can be kind of tough to showcase them because people are really into what the cards do. So you spend a lot of time just talking about the strategic elements of the game, and the artwork sometimes doesn't get its due attention.
Let's talk about the competition side of Magic. Sean mentioned the top eight. For those who don't know that much about Magic, or specifically the Magic Pro Tour, tell us more about the top eight and what that signifies.
Sure. The top eight is like the end of the tournament. And it's literally just the best eight players from that weekend play in a playoff, like a single elimination playoff. The way Magic tournaments are structured is there will be hundreds of players, in some instances, thousands of players. I think the most popular tournament that's happened, it was close to 5,000 players. We have what's called a Swiss structure, where people are assigned opponents randomly that have the same record as them, so that the best records will constantly be facing off against one another, and so the cream of the crop will be slowly whittled down and rise to the top. And so then at the end of the day, you know, the people who have gone 12-3 or 13-2 or something like that will reach the top eight, and then that's like the playoffs. And from there you've got quarterfinals, semifinals, and then a finals, and then there's a champion who holds up a trophy and a large novelty check at the end. So it takes a lot of work. I don't think a lot of new players really understand how hard competitive Magic players have to work and how many hours they need to log in order to reach that elite skill level. They also need to have a lot of natural talent. They need to be able to make calculations in their head at a very quick speed. They need to be able to read their opponent and not give away clues as to what they might have in their hand. It's a popular game, so lots and lots of people are playing it and trying to get really good. And certainly no Magic player makes their living with prize checks from tournaments. It's very small. Most pro Magic players will get lucky every once in a while and end up with a prize check, but they'll make their kind of everyday living from appearance fees at pro tournaments or content that they create for blogs, popular ones being Channel Fireball or Star City Games. They write strategy articles or create little YouTube videos, instructional stuff. So that's kind of the life of a pro, and Sean and I have been shadowing them, documenting them, and talking to them for about 5 years now. I think we've gotten a good look under the hood, I guess, of what it takes to be a pro Magic player, especially as we move into a more pure documentary style with Enter the Battlefield.
We're toward the end of 2016 now, and another part of being a pro player is travel. Tournaments all over the world, I believe 4 big ones every year. If you're on the Pro Tour? And where are those?
Sure. There's 4 Pro Tours per year, and then there's also the World Championship and also the World Magic Cup, which is kind of like the World Cup, you know, of soccer, but for Magic. It's a team competition between 72 different countries. So that's kind of 6 major events of the year. They're all invite only. The only way you can play in a Pro Tour is by winning a local tournament called a Pro Tour qualifier, or by having done well enough in previous high-level tournaments that you've earned enough pro points to earn a spot in the Pro Players Club. Plane tickets are awarded to players that do well, that alleviate their travel costs, and in some instances, hotel accommodations for the very, very successful Magic players. So part of what's becoming a pro is trying to earn your way onto what they call the train or the gravy train, where you're getting your flights paid for, you got your hotel paid for, you've got a nice little appearance fee for playing in a pro tour, and you can kind of piece it together. It's not a king's ransom by any means. You know, you're probably working as hard as graduate students work for less money than graduate students make, which anybody who goes to grad school will probably shudder to think of. But, you know, hey, that's the price that you got to pay to play your favorite fantasy card game for a living.
And where did those big events take place in 2016?
I'll try to think. In 2016?
You can think about it.
Sure. They usually have 1 or 2 in the U.S. Per year. Whether it's, you know, in Milwaukee or Atlanta or Seattle. They usually have 1 or 2 in Europe per year, whether it's in Rotterdam or Brussels, Belgium or Barcelona, Spain. And every once in a long while, they'll do a Pro Tour in Japan. I believe they have a Pro Tour in Kyoto coming up in 2017. But for the most part, it's in the U.S. and Europe. And there was recently one in Sydney, Australia as well that was pretty fun to attend and special.
And you guys just got back from covering an event in Chile. Tell me about that, and let's use that as an opportunity to segue into your current strategy of coverage for Enter the Battlefield.
We were winding down Walking the Plains and transitioning to Enter the Battlefield, a much more documentary-style approach, a personal, up-close, getting to know players on a very personal, intimate level, getting to know their families. So it wasn't just about goofy segments and sketch comedy anymore. It's more personal. So we went to Santiago, Chile to film the 2nd episode of Enter the Battlefield, the series, which is our spin-off of Enter the Battlefield, the feature, which is available on Netflix. Shameless plug. But in Chile, there was an open tournament, or I guess an amateur-level tournament called a Grand Prix. You don't need to be a pro. There's no invitations. It's open for all to attend. And it's a big, you know, 1,000 or so people show up and compete, try to make the top 8. So Sean and I went there. We met a bunch of Latin American players. The scene in Latin America is small, but it is growing. It's growing fast. There were representatives from national teams that were going to play in the World Magic Cup. We talked a lot to Team Argentina and Team Chile. Magic coverage hasn't really gotten much to Latin America. And so for us, it was a neat opportunity to bring a spotlight to players that don't usually get to be in it. That spotlight. And so we hope to do more of that with Enter the Battlefield going forward. We're a small unit. We're 2 people. You know, we've never had like the full documentary professional setup, but I think we've done really well packing lightly. And so we hope to get to some of the corners of the world where there are Magic players that are not typically featured as they are in US or Europe or Japan.
Sean, I want to talk about the film version of Enter the Battlefield, and specifically about the stories you told and chose to tell in that documentary. Take me through, first of all, how many people did you interview first for Enter the Battlefield? And then what did it get whittled down to? And what was the decision process for deciding who made the cut for the film?
Yeah, so deciding who to include in the film was a long process. We started, I guess, with kind of a long list of, I don't know, maybe 10 people we were even just very lightly considering. We did interview a few of them, not even on camera. We just talked to a few of them at a tournament at the time and I don't think we even told them what we were doing. I think we were just kind of feeling it out and just seeing it, what we felt about these people, these players. And then we, I think, settled on a couple players pretty early. I would say Chris Pakula was probably the earliest player we really nailed down. We knew we were going to include him for a multitude of reasons. But then as we continued on in the production process, we kind of added players as we went, in a sense. And then I'd say maybe halfway through production or a third of the way through, that's when we really settled into our kind of roster of players that we were 100% to include. That process, it was a pretty complex process. There were a lot of different reasons we wanted to include people or felt compelled to. Some were, you know, creative reasons. Others were we just felt it was important for a certain player to be involved because they brought a nice perspective that we wanted to include as far as what pro players experience.
Now, taking up from that, the first episode of the Now series for Enter the Battlefield, tell me about what the concept was for that and how it played out.
As Nate said, when we were wrapping up Walking the Plains, it was a very conscious decision that we wanted to move kind of, I guess, back towards that sort of journalistic approach from the film. We wanted to tell these human interest stories because that really is, you know, it's not that high on the list of, if you ask the average Magic player what they want to know about, it's not about the players, usually. It's about the cards or new elements being brought into the game or a new set. And there's not a lot of attention put on the actual players, whether it be pro players or just casual players. There's a lot of content out there about strategy and just cards. Our focus has been and will be for the near future, at least, the players. And we just wanted to get back to that because we really enjoyed making the film. And we just wanted to continue that process. So we basically just decided to kind of take that film concept and just break it down into a series. So we're kind of following a pretty similar model, picking our subjects, traveling to their hometowns or nearby towns and showing what their experience is like on a local level and not necessarily focusing on the tournaments and just trying to show what these people are really like.
And it seems having Wizards of the Coast backing you gives you the opportunity to tell that local story on an international scale.
That's the hope. I don't imagine we'll be able to do that for every episode, but yes, that's definitely a priority that we want to be including players from different countries. It's an international game. We want to show that. And it can be hard, you know, like Nate said, we're two people, so it can be a little challenging, but, you know, this trip to Santiago worked out really well, and we're planning on doing that in the future, but we're also planning trips, you know, in the U.S. But yes, we definitely want to make it a priority to be traveling the globe and showing players from all walks of life.
Let's talk about the whole idea of two real people facing each other across a table in an era where digital video gaming seems to pervade everything. Tell me about that aspect as a strength for this game.
I think it's undeniably a strength because it's different. Like you said, most gaming these days is done digitally, whether you're playing an Xbox or, you know, playing a little game on your phone, whether you're playing internet poker or whatnot. And tabletop games, the kinds where people just get together to have fun and look each other in the eye and have conversations and share social experiences, is different than that. I certainly am in tune with how, you know, because we have little entertainment devices that follow us everywhere we go, it's really easy to kind of get sucked into your own little bubble of watching entertainment that caters only to you everywhere you go, and you're watching it by yourself. You're plugged in with your headphones, etc. So I love the idea that for kids or for adults, that Magic is a game that is played in person. And I think Wizards of the Coast has done well. They're not the biggest company in the world. Magic's not the biggest game in the world. But I believe it's the most successful tabletop game in the world. Maybe more money is exchanged playing poker, but poker isn't an intellectual property that is owned by anyone. Company, Magic cards. There are a lot. That's a lot of cardboard being sold. People get together and play, and it attracts collectors. It attracts gamers. It attracts people who like social gaming, competitive gaming. I think it's a nice print medium in this age of digital distribution.
And sticking with the poker comparison for a second, it's a game that seems with each new set to evolve. From your research, your interactions on your series, what do you suppose the mindset is within Wizards of keeping this as an ever-evolving game?
It's absolutely integral to the game that it's always evolving and new cards are always coming out. And it kind of serves a dual purpose. One, it's convenient for selling things. There's always a new toy to buy. That's how Wizards of the Coast stays in business. Whereas with poker, it's going to be the same 52 cards forever and ever. And Magic has tens of thousands of different cards. If I haven't played Magic with you before, I may show up to play against you and I may have never seen the cards that you play with before, even having been a player myself for many, many years. I don't think there's anybody in the world who has played extensively with every single Magic card many times. So it's personal. You can create a deck to your liking. You can play with elves, or you can play with dragons, or you can play with giant trees, whatever you're into, rats, knights, cats. There are so many different ways to do it. You can play spells that don't do a whole lot in the beginning of the game, but allow you to play something huge at the end of the game. Or you can play lots of little spells in the beginning of the game to kind of blitz out your opponent with a goblin attack with little creatures. And there's all different strategies in between. There's combinations of cards that are really bad on their own, but when they're combined with other cards, suddenly they become very powerful. And there's lots of creativity and personalization, and I think that's a central part of the appeal of the game, is that your deck is kind of a part of you. It's like it's your weapon of choice. You know, some people prefer the samurai sword, some people prefer the staff if you're a wizard in the forest. So it's a big part of the game.
And you guys are at heart storytellers. Another thing I wanted to make sure I talked to you about is that on Wizards of the Coast site, each set has itself an ongoing story that tells the story of each of the sets. If you go to the website within Wizards of the Coast for each of their, like, the Magic sets.
Well, now they have short stories.
The short stories.
Yeah, yeah. They call it Magic Story, and you can read these short stories on the website that are written in prose and describe the characters and the plots that are in these sets. It's usually a difficult story to tell because Magic is played in as a card game, and you only see a little glimpse of the story on any given card, and you might play those cards out of order. You're typically playing them for their strategic value, not for their narrative value, although there are some hardcore nerds that do the former. There used to be ebooks, there used to be paperback novels going way back in the day that captured the lore. So there is this like fantasy story background to the game that a lot of customers consume. Although I would say, for the most part, people like to play on the ironies of bizarre flavor interactions. Like, I'm going to give a bat an extra set of wings, but they're angel's wings, and the bat's going to hold a spear and ride on top of a Pegasus. It's an absurd image, but these are the kinds of things you could do in the game. And I think people are more drawn to those bizarre interactions, whether for humor for a casual player or just for the way the strategy or the game itself plays out for the competitive player.
Since you guys started, the ways that people can consume the content that you guys create have increased. It's no longer just YouTube. It's no longer just a desktop. It's mobile. It's multiple sites. What are your thoughts on that, the idea of people being able to consume Enter the Battlefield as a series in different forms? Does that come into your thinking when you're filming and editing it? Does that affect your filmmaking style?
It definitely does affect our approach in a number of ways. I think the greatest of which is, I think, the editing. I know my own attention span has shortened over the years. So Nate and I will talk a lot about the episode length, but even more so than that, it's the pacing. You know, a lot of times we're just interviewing players about their lives and playing Magic, and you know, that can kind of drag on if you don't have something else interesting going on in the middle. So we have to come up with some spicy elements to include in each episode to keep it fun, keep the pace up. Because, yeah, you're right. People are watching these episodes on the subway, on their phone, while they're doing homework. You have no idea. So, yeah, I don't think we have the luxury to just tell a 25-minute story and assume people will just sit there through the whole thing. We're definitely aware that in this age, you have to be aware of that. And I think this project is a little different because we're also excited about the premiere of each episode for this new project is basically during the stream of each Pro Tour. So the first place people will see it is that way. It'll be separated into two parts, part one, part two. Part one is shown on, I guess, the Friday of each Pro Tour, and then part two will be on Saturday. And that's something we've been wanting to do for a while, and now that's happening. So these players we're featuring, these pro players, these casual players, they're getting a pretty big audience of people who are watching the Pro Tour. And like I said, these are stories that are not told very often. So it's really nice that it'll be highlighted on that kind of stage every time. That's the plan going forward. And we'll see. Outside of that, we don't know how much people want to hear these stories. We want to tell them, and we're hoping to make them more popular because we want to, that's the goal. We want to feature players, and we're hoping that people want to connect to that kind of story going forward.
Where can people connect with that online at the moment? Where would you recommend?
There's a couple ways you can find our content, specifically Enter the Battlefield, the series. If you just search for it on YouTube, you'll find it. If you go on the Magic the Gathering YouTube account, they publish the videos after every Pro Tour. They stream them during every Pro Tour. So if you choose to watch any Pro Tour coverage, you'll see them during the stream. We tweet out whenever an episode's going live, and that would be at Walk the Plains. That's really Nate's Twitter account, but he promotes our work very diligently, so you could hear it there. If you haven't seen the film, that is available on Netflix as well as YouTube, and the Walk the Plane series is also in its entirety available on YouTube.
What's the plan for 2017?
In 2017, we're really going to kick Enter the Battlefield into high gear. We've made two episodes at the end of 2016. We were kind of juggling a lot of balls in 2016, so to speak. And in 2017, we were really going to laser focus on making Enter the Battlefield the series really great. We plan to go to Japan this year, which will be a first for us. And it's something that the Japanese Magic community doesn't get much of from Western Hemisphere media. So that'll be exciting. And we're going to go everywhere else that the Pro Tour goes. Sean and I are also hoping to make more content geared towards the casual Magic player. We have a series called First Friday that we've done a couple episodes of. You can search for that on YouTube. And that features local game stores, which are kind of the bread and butter of the Magic community. Pro tournaments represent the 0.1% of elite skill, but most Magic players, you know, go to your local game store the way someone goes to a bar or to the gym or something. It's just a place in their life where they can go and meet like-minded people and share games and, you know, maybe buy a soda and a couple of packs of Magic cards to pay the rent for an actual brick-and-mortar store here in the 21st century. So First Friday covers that. And other than that, we have some pretty cool ideas I can't share publicly yet that will hopefully, if they can be produced, we're making our pitch, as it were, that will also help the accessibility of the game to people who aren't familiar with it and allow, you know, new players to jump in with a little bit more knowledge than they would otherwise.
Again, you can follow news of Enter the Battlefield, the series, as well as Nathaniel and Sean's other film work on Twitter, at Walk the Plains. Talking Paper interviews like this one are part of a great Thursday lineup of shows for what is now season 4 of Radio Free Brooklyn. So help us to keep bringing those shows to you by giving to our Patreon at radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. Give as much as you'd like and get great perks in return. For the second part of this episode of Talking Paper, I interviewed one of the 7 subjects of the film version of Enter the Battlefield, Chris Pakula, from his home in Philadelphia over Skype. Will Wheaton provides the following intro to Pakula's section of Enter the Battlefield.
Respected as both a competitor and a positive influence on the integrity of tournament magic, Chris Pakula is one of the biggest stars from the early days of the Pro Tour. After a vaunted career at the top tables in the 1990s, Chris focused less on competitive success and more on his career and family. But his passion for the game and desire to play on the Pro Tour never left him. Now at the age of 40, he has struggled to earn an invitation back to the Pro Tour. To return to the big stage, he'll need to start by winning a local Pro Tour Qualifier Tournament, or PTQ.
For this Talking Paper interview, I began by asking Chris about how he first became aware of the video work of Nathaniel and Sean.
Before it was called Walking the Plank, they did their first video when the Pro Tour was in Philadelphia, which I guess was like 2011, maybe 2010. When all the Magic players saw that, it was just, you know, we were all really excited. It was like just so much better than anything else we'd seen as far as like just people just making a Magic tournament video. And then they asked for some, like, they did some crowdfunding for the second video they made, and I contributed to that. And that's basically how I got to know those guys. That's where it started.
Let's keep on that topic for a second of video depictions of Magic. Something as an outsider to me that I'm fascinated by is that at actual tournaments, there's essentially, the first thing that popped into my head was poker-style camera work trying to tell the visual tale of Magic to a viewing audience. What's your take on the in-house style used on the Pro Tour?
The visual style they use, I think, is pretty good. It's just very difficult for non-Magic players to really have any idea what's going on, and I don't know if there's any way to really bridge that gap. So I think it's very much done in a way such that it appeals to Magic players, and I don't really see a reason to do otherwise. If you're not a serious Magic player trying to sit down and watch one of these tournaments, I feel like it's probably pretty hopeless, unless you're just someone who's interested in kind of games or weird things, and you just not knowing would get you excited about it just because it looks so complicated. But it's definitely not very good at communicating what's going on to the casual person. You know, obviously I can nitpick individual commentators or individual tournaments or whatever, but I think overall, I think the general style they do it is about what you'd expect. I haven't heard many ideas as far as doing something drastically differently.
What's your take on Nate and Sean's personal style in Enter the Battlefield, telling the stories of you guys, the players, as an entree to telling the story of Magic?
Right, so they very much don't really bother with like the game itself. You know, I think Enter the Battlefield only has one detail, one game where I messed up, where they kind of explain like a strategic thing. But they don't really get into like the details of strategies or anything like they would do when you cover sports. There's no discussion of statistics or strategies or, you know, they'll mention how many top eights someone has because that's how, you know, Magic really gets talked about all the time in terms of accomplishments. But it's really about the people and about their personalities and very little about the games of Magic itself. And they try to do that. The other people who cover tournaments try to kind of do, like, you know, the kind of human interest stories they would do in between action and any sporting event, like during the Super Bowl or the baseball playoffs or whatever. They might do a story on someone and what they do off the field when there's no action going on. But I don't think anyone else is really as good at that as they are.
Give me an update on your own Magic playing habits these days. When last I left your story in Enter the Battlefield, it seemed like you were continuing on. Are you still pursuing tournament play?
I have been pursuing tournament play, but I've been pretty unsuccessful the past couple of years. Really just average results, not really done what I want to do at all. I did get back on the Hall of Fame ballot, and getting the Hall of Fame is, you know, very important to me, but it's not clear that I kind of nickel and dime my way back onto the ballot rather than having a really great finish anywhere. So it's unclear if I'll get voted in, even though I am back on the ballot. So last 2 years have kind of been disappointing in terms of my Magic results. And I have been playing, you know, not a ton, but I've definitely been playing.
This is a narrative point in Enter the Battlefield. They mention your career top eight finishes. 3 versus 4, I believe, was the big difference there. As somebody who's waiting on the call for the Hall of Fame, do you see it as essentially a mathematical equation? Or is it more political than that?
No, it's definitely not pure mathematical. I mean, I feel like I'm one of the very few people who could get voted in with less than four. I think a lot of people respect my contributions to the game as far as like trying to get rid of cheating and just promoting the game in general. And I also think that there's definitely a subgroup of voters who think that the people who played a long time ago, for whatever reasons, the mathematical numbers don't really tell the whole story just because Magic was structured so differently back then. So I think I could get in with just three Pro Tour top eights. But like I said, you know, I've almost got in so many times and I don't even know how different the voting group is than it was the last time I was on the ballot. So who knows? I think I'm an underdog, but I think I could still get in with my current achievements.
Let's go back to your efforts against cheating in the game. Since your early efforts to today, can you in brief tell me your observations of how the game has evolved to deal with that issue?
Yeah, there's actually just a big cheating issue in Magic this week. The toughest thing about Magic and cheating, you know, every once in a while you catch a blatant cheater. It's like, no question, this guy was cheating. It's ridiculous. And then it's very easy on how to deal with it. Magic is a very complicated game. It's just got a lot more going on than any other game that's played live. When you play Magic on the computer, it takes care of everything for you. You can't break the rules. When you play a board game with you and your friends, you know, when little kids play Monopoly, they break the rules all the time because they just don't know what the rules should be. Magic, not because it's little kids playing, but because of the sheer complexity, the people playing just mess up and essentially break the rules. Like they pay 3 mana for something that costs 4 mana, or they accidentally draw 3 cards and they're supposed to draw 2 cards, or they were supposed to deal 4 damage and they only dealt 3 damage. And it just, you know, people are keeping track of the scores with pen and paper, and there's just a lot going on, so people make mistakes. The complicated part is, sometimes you'll see a pattern of mistakes, and then you have to say, well, is this person just careless, or are they confused, or are they really systematically trying to, you know, get a little edge here and there by making what look like harmless mistakes that are actually cheating? And that's actually, it's a big issue right now that I've been talking about to a few other pros about this week, and it's not really clear how you handle it. Like, they're, you know, when someone makes a mistake that's in their favor and they're like, oh, I just forgot what was going on, it's very believable. But at the same time, if someone does that, you know, every other tournament in clutch spots, you're going to have to say, wow, this is a lot of mistakes in your favor, man. So I don't know how good of a job the DCI and Wizards of the Coast is doing of tracking this kind of thing, because it's pretty tough. But I think they are trying to. So And of course, with social media now, someone cheats and it's like on camera. Well, I say cheats. Someone does something that looks like it could be cheating on camera, and it's unclear whether or not they did it on purpose, but then you post a video. Now some people are like, oh, you're trying to start a witch hunt, this guy's never cheated. You know, no one really knows how to handle it. It's tough.
Let's talk about Magic the game as a paper game. Someone like yourself who's been playing it as long as you have, do you think part of the longevity, the fact that Magic, compared to almost any other game, has users who stick with it longer than other games, do you think it's that tactile paper nature of it? Is it the social nature of it, the fact that you're facing against one person rather than a video game where it can feel lonely or disconnected? What's your take on the tactile paper benefits of Magic toward its popularity?
I actually don't think it being paper is that big of a factor. Once you separate the collectability part, right? The collectability aspect of it is certainly part of it. And obviously that would be less true if it wasn't paper. One of the big things about Magic is that it's a game that is very complicated, but still when people play for the first time, it's often when they're very young. So I think that there is just a lot of nostalgia involved. You know, it's fantasy and has a lot of cool art. And I think there's a lot of things that appeal to kids that something like chess would. And I don't think you can really be that nostalgic about your chess set when you're growing up compared to how you could to like your Magic cards when you're growing up. I think the other thing is this is kind of, I don't think people talk about this a lot, but Magic is just a much better game now than it was 20 years ago. So people started playing 20 years ago, you know, I started playing when I was 19, so I guess like 22 years ago. The first few years I played, Magic was so bad compared to how it was. I mean, like the design of the game, how good of a game it is, not the exterior stuff like tournament conditions or whatever. So the fact that the game has basically constantly been getting better makes it really hard to quit because you've loved this thing for so long. And it's not like it's the same old, we're just still doing the same thing. It's like every year the game is better. So how am I going to quit when I can have a better version of this thing I've loved for more than half my life at this point?
In recent years, do you have a specific set that you especially like that has touched a chord with you that you've continued on with, even as new sets after that have come?
No, I don't think. I think players like me tend to not think in terms like that. You know, every once in a while there's a format we really like or a format we don't like very much. A lot of it is concentrated on limited play, which is mostly booster drafting. So a lot of times if a set is really unpopular with serious players, it'll be because booster drafting is not fun. There have been sets such as Avacyn Restore that almost are universally hated because of how bad of booster draft formats they were. I think everyone really enjoyed the return to Innistrad. That was just a really great format the first time around. And I don't know, there just haven't been many bad sets. So it's almost like people remember the bad ones much, much more than the good ones because the bad ones stick out. The good ones are so common now that they don't really stand out to me as much.
Playing Magic since you were 19, what's it like playing against someone now who's 19? Does youth or experience come with its own advantages, disadvantages in your view?
I would say that in general, I don't get, you know, any advantages versus playing someone. No one's really intimidated by you being older. I would say every once in a while, if someone knows who I am, they might be somewhat intimidated just because they, this guy's on meddling age or whatever. But I don't think there's many 19-year-olds that play someone who's 35 or 40 and are naturally intimidated. It can almost be the opposite, where if you're older and they don't know who you are, now they probably don't think you're that serious. The biggest problem I have with age gaps is when I play someone who's clearly under 18 years old. Like I played in a Grand Prix last year, and I was paired versus, I think, a 13-year-old. And it was his first Grand Prix, and he made a mistake to lose on the very last turn of the game. Like, he had the game won. The only way I could win was if he made a mistake, and he made the mistake. And I just feel like we both felt terrible because, you know, I traveled to the Grand Prix, and I'm trying to win, so I can't really just let the kid win. And now he feels terrible because he's at his first Grand Prix, and he, you know, was going to beat someone who's clearly an experienced player, and then he just messed up on the last turn, and it's just like, I felt pretty bad, and I would never feel like that beating a 19-year-old or a 25-year-old or a 60-year-old. It was really just the fact that he was 13 or 14 that made it somewhat, kind of made the experience worse for me.
Chris Pakula, thank you for being on Talking Paper.
Well, thanks for having me.
You can follow Chris Pakula on Twitter at Meddling Mage. Finally, as 2016 comes to a close, Talking Paper would like to highlight the published paper work of three of my favorite poets, Bonnie Joy, Chris Campagnoni, and Malik Crumpler. This is How I Walk Into My Own Film from Bonnie Joy's book Before, During, or After Rainstorms. There's a gravestone in the parking lot by the flea market, and Terry keeps appearing in the laundry room when the fluorescent light blinks. Then she's a leaf lost in an apartment complex lobby. She asks the same question over and over. I answer her, mostly petal storms and clear. The child next door begins to scream some self-deprecating bullshit, and Terry evaporates. On the subway, I almost sit next to the newspaper snapper, but at the last minute he's shell-shocked by a punk song on his iPod and begins stamping his feet. I hold my penknife in my lap, just in case. On Howard, near Canal, there's an undercover sale. I have a high heel hangover and glean some ideas for elevator horror from a guy with severe party face. On a billboard, a sign painter slops an outline of a washing machine next to a shirtless male model advertising baking soda. Next, I go to the man-made lake for an electric boat ride. We find out what's in chocolate, anandamide, and euphoria. I jot down some ideas for a restaurant, half glad of the stupid open mouths. We pass a man catching and releasing catfish. He has long hairs curling around his nose. Raindrops tickle the back of my neck as we glide up the bird sanctuary. The information booth has a few trail pamphlets of bird horoscopes native to Brooklyn Rail. Mourning dove, Argentine monk, vulture, and T-bird. I wonder which one I should read. I chose Tern and discover this week the weather will set my mood. Lightning snaps and I run for cover on the patio. Others follow, and I find myself pressed next to a human-sized frog sculpture. I run toward my apartment for a few blocks. Yesterday's massage shivers through me. As I gather closer, Terry flashes into view and asks, "How do you like this crazy weather?" I waver away, aiming to reach the lobby before I get soaked. The wind is holding the door open a crack, inside the smell of incense and cooked chicken. The elevator door opens empty. The hallway light flickers as I check my mailbox. The lobby cam films me. This is Death of the Artist, from Chris Campagnoni's book, Death of Art. I want you now like a TV show. It's been so slow this pilot season, waiting for something good to come on the air, is full of eyes killing, time or under hoods. Of unmarked cars, as in a stakeout cop, of feel in secret, all fish under, remember? The pleasure of getting wet, drying off again, sometimes. Joy is simple. This smell of swimming pools, this smell of dust and skin, will never leave me, or never leave, a beginning to mark its end, kaput, pulp, and worms. A mound of shit. Did I ever mention I couldn't read words until I was six? A whole life, half listening to my mother and father, speaking in each mother tongue, to be confused, or maybe to just be alone, silent and sitting, closer to the sound of it. Do you happen to know any tricks for better living? Left, right, up, down, select or something similar? Still, time enough before I leave to get sated for a few singles. Something singular and hopeful, a hushed word of thanks or thankless prayer. Who knocks at this door? Long pause in which you swallow. Who answers? This is from Malik Crumpler's book, Little Everywhere. Child asks parents, "Where do all the smells go when they go away?" Parents respond in unison. They offer themselves into that ancient rift, always parallel to every here, every now, every then, every when, every possible possibility, just as every action done is done in all the everythings, everything for infinity, into the lungs of trees, stones, plants, and other yous in other planes, all things always-ing, in every possible now, nowing, above, 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 below, 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 beside, 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 inside, inside, inside. The quick child clapped three times, and when the echo hit, the multi-airs lit, hollering back, above, 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 below, 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 beside, 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 inside, inside, inside. Such is the first memory of the first child ever anywhere. It is neither boy nor girl. It was a simple child. Its parents called it Little Everywhere. Finally, this is What's Been Going On Around Here, from Bonnie Joy's Before, During, or After Rainstorms. All the firecrackers are soaked. At this moment, I'm pouring myself into my pants. The important ducats go by water taxi, mailbox to theater box. I drink bubbly water out of blue glass bottles, a door wrapping myself in a silver throw. Boom, my outfit lights up. I close the shades like a criminal. The side views from the escalator are my particular hell. It seems as though everyone who walks by eats while doing the gangster lean. I listen and put cream on my face after another night on the town. The confetti doesn't make me any better. I'm still the heartthrob of the basement crowd. That's all for this episode of Talking Paper. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.